Okay, so Shavuos is approaching, and it's a time for us to talk about women and Matan Torah. Now you could ask, why are we talking about women and Matan Torah? Why not talk about Matan Torah? So the reason is the Torah, by its definition, what does the word Torah mean? It comes from the word Hora'ah, which means instruction. Women aren't obligated to study Torah. So the question is, what is women's relationship to study, to all of this instruction, if we don't have an obligation to study? So a simple answer would be we have an obligation to know, as opposed to an obligation to learn. And whether the knowledge comes through learning, or through osmosis, or through oral teaching, as long as the result is knowing, then women have fulfilled their obligation. That's the simple answer to this, and it's a true answer. But what we have to get into on a much, much deeper level is, why are women's obligations different than men, and how do they play out? So this question is especially telling when you look at the way the Torah was actually given. So just by way of introduction, the Torah is full of laws and narratives, right? So the whole book of Bereshis is narrative. There are very few laws in Bereshis. In fact, Brit Milah and Gid HaNasha is basically all there is. Shemot also has a great deal of narrative, some law. It has law, but a great deal of narrative. It's only when you get to Vayikra that you get a whole sefer that's full of law, yet the Torah is all called Hora'ah. It's all called instruction. So what kind of instructions do you get in Bereshis? Where are the instructions there when you have stories? So Ramban asks this question, and he asks it from a deeper perspective. He says, when you look at Parashat Bereshit, the story of the creation, we don't really understand the story of the creation because we don't have a frame of reference. So if we don't really understand it, why is it there? The Torah could have begun. Everything in the world is a consequence of God's will, and here's what he wants of you. Next. So what he answers is that the narratives in Chumash Bereshis and the narratives in general are to give us what we would call vicarious experiential learning, learning that we see through example. So to take this one step deeper, the most significant difference between a human being and anything else that's there in creation is our ability to make choices. So all choices that you make, all moral choices and even other choices, all choices are based on your knowledge, or at least your supposition, of what the consequence of your choice will be. So I want to give you an example. You get up in the morning. Why? Because you heard the alarm clock ring. What makes you decide to get out of bed or turn over? No? You've been there.
You don't want to hear the alarm clock anymore.
Okay, you don't want to hear the alarm clock. You could just toss the alarm clock onto the floor and break it, cover it with 5 blankets and a pillow. What gets you out of bed? Ah, the consequences of not getting out of bed. You may lose your job. Okay, your kids may decide they don't want to go to school today. Okay, there are all sorts of negative consequences that may be the result of you not getting out of bed. Okay, after you're out of bed, okay, what do you do next? No? Okay, netilat yadayim, moda'ani, bathroom, shower. All of these choices, which are very small choices, are made on the basis you're realizing. You want to look good. You want to smell good. It's better to take a shower. Okay. Every choice you make is based on some sort of a realization of there being consequences to your choices. So what the Torah is doing by giving us narrative is telling us what the outcome of our choices are. So in all of Chumash Bereshis, from the beginning of, and Adam had a very good case built up for eating of the forbidden fruit, which was that he would integrate evil and good within him, so his choices would have deeper and more profound meaning. Sounds like a good idea on paper, but it didn't really work. Okay, so the consequence of disobeying God's will is that you get unexpected negative results that you couldn't have possibly anticipated, given what the human mind is. Lesson two, the flood. You can go on and on. So the reason I'm taking you through this is I want you to carefully listen to the narrative that preceded the way the Torah was given. Okay, so way before the Torah was actually given, Hashem had told Moshe that he's going to go and liberate the Jews from Egypt and bring them back to this mountain, to serve me. You might recall from Pesach, although Pesach happened a little while ago and some of us have bad short-term memories, but you might recall how you said, Ilu karvenu lefnei har Sinai, dayenu. Try to be there. Don't you think it would be a little anticlimactic? Well, here we are! Okay. So what's this all about? So the Torah would have been given, but it had to be given at Mount Sinai, at Har Sinai. So a Gemara that you're familiar with, which is also in Midrash, is that the mountains were arguing about which mountain should be the one in which the Torah was given. They all pointed out their various advantages and virtues, except Har Sinai, which said, who am I? So the idea is, first step in the narrative, the way you come to receiving Torah isn't by talking about your advantages and capacities, but what? Who am I? Keep this in the back of your mind. This is very important for our discussion of women and Torah. You begin by saying, who am I? Okay, then you have Hashem informing everybody about what Torah is for. I'm going to give you this, and it's going to cause you to emerge into being Goy Kadosh u'mamlechet Kohanim. So let's talk about these two phrases. You'll be a holy nation. You have to be small enough. You have to be like Har Sinai. You'll be a holy nation. What does holy mean? What does the word holy mean?
Separate.
Okay, it means separate. Separate from what? When you say Hashem is holy, Kadosh Hashem, separate from what? You must have wondered about that at some point, no? Separate from everything that limits. So I want to tell you there are many different levels of Kedusha. When you look at us, we're very limited. Our lives are short, we're very subjective, we have ego agendas, desire agendas, we're very limited. Hashem has no limitations. There's no outside force or inside force that makes him be less than himself. Is that true? So people could be relatively holy, but not absolutely holy. So the first thing Hashem says is you'll be Goy Kadosh, you'll be a people who know how to release themselves from limitation. You'll be separate in that regard. So the way that that takes place in the Torah itself is through the negative mitzvot. Every negative mitzvah frees you in some way. Give me an example of any negative mitzvah. Don't kill. Whenever I say give a negative mitzvah, somebody says kill. I won't think too deeply about what this says about our collective consciousness. Okay, but no one ever says don't break Shabbos. Okay, in any case, so don't murder. Okay, how would murder make you a less free person? How would it make you smaller, more enslaved? So I want to give you a halachic definition of murder. Murder is when you kill someone who's of no threat to you. Why would anyone commit murder? I'm thinking the person is genuinely not a threat. They don't even... Okay, you've heard of murders. Why do people kill people? Okay. Power, conquest, fear. Are all of those feelings imprisoning? They are. Okay. So the Torah is going to free you. It'll make you kadosh. The other side is mamlechet kohanim, will be a kingdom of kohanim. What do kohanim do?
Serve Hashem.
Everyone serves Hashem, right? So in the Beit HaMikdash, they served Hashem by doing what? What was the main form of their service? The korbanos. So I want to put in a good word for korbanos. Okay, people, you know how, let's be real for a minute, then we can go back to being our defensive selves. We all like to learn, otherwise we wouldn't be here, right? So here it is, you're learning Parsha, like the Parshiot and Bereishis are interesting. Then you get to Shemos. And then once you get past Parshas Mishpatim, okay, could you find yourself saying, oh, Mishkan, 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 Mishkan. Okay, and then you get on to Chumash Vayikra, and then what do you say? Korban, 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 okay, whatever, until you get to Parshas Kedoshim and you breathe again. So, I want you to know that there's a Gemara that says that the entire world was created for the Korbanos. What's this supposed to mean? The word Korban is rooted in the word Karov. Now, you can only make something near if it begins what? Far. If something is near, you can't make it near. Okay, so Hashem created a world in which there's a great deal of spiritual distance between the material realities of the world and Him. What a korban does is teach you how to take something far, which is material reality, and draw it close. So as you know, many of you are familiar with this very well-known Ramban, when a korban was being offered, the person was supposed to identify with the animal and say, I wish I could dedicate myself to Hashem in this way. Okay, you read through other Mephorshim, it'll say, well, the sheep, I wish I could dedicate my following capacity to Hashem. A ram, I wish I could give my leadership. I wish I could be totally dedicated. I wish I could take the parts of me that are far and draw them close. This is the source of all the positive mitzvot. Every positive mitzvah gives you the ability to take something that either is far or could be far and make it close. Give me an example of any positive mitzvah. What? Lighting candles is tricky. It's a mitzvah midrabanan. I don't want to go there. That's part of Shabbos. Okay, honoring parents. How many of you find honoring parents a very easy mitzvah where it just comes spontaneously, it flows? Okay, anybody? It's the hardest mitzvah in the Torah. You gave an example. Okay. So the idea is as follows. Your ego and your selfishness are big impediments to your closeness to Hashem. When you dedicate yourself to honoring your parents, guess what? You've taken the part of yourself that could be humble, the part of yourself that could be dedicated, and you've given it a voice. It's not mute. This would be the case with giving tzedakah. Money could make you very far. I don't have to give you examples of how far money could take people. But when you give tzedakah, you're taking money that you earned and dedicating it and letting it draw closer, saying a bracha takes food, which could certainly make you very distant and animalistic. And it acts as a bridge between you and Hashem suddenly instead of a wall. Okay, so we know Hashem's going to give us positive mitzvahs and negative mitzvahs, turn us into a goy kadosh, mamlechet kohanim. And then you notice that there's a separation. Now this separation of genders, it's not the first time that we have this appearing in Torah. It's right there in the creation narrative. Hashem created Adam, who had at that point the du partzufim, all of the capacities, male and female, sort of like amoeba, could have reproduced him herself. Hashem says it's not good for a human to be alone. And suddenly we find ourselves with two genders, Ish and Isha. What's that about? Hashem did not have to create a world in which there were two genders. He could have created a unisex world in which everybody would basically do the same thing in their own individual ways, because people have individual tendencies, and we'd live happily ever after, which is the ideal that the secular society currently pursues. Why did Hashem say it's not good? What's not good about a single gender world? Good. So there are two answers to that. Very good. One answer, which is the answer that Rashi gives, is that a self-sufficient person will not seek anything beyond self. So the idea of saying, I have it all, I don't need anyone, that cuts a person off from seeking God, from seeking other people. It creates an egotism that makes them cut off from anything that requires humility. So let's go back to how the Torah was given. It had to be given where? At Har Sinai, the mountain that said, I'm nothing. Self-sufficiency and autonomy creates the mentality of saying, I'm everything. Okay, problem A. So problem A has to do with inability to receive. But then there's problem B. Problem B is that there's also the inability to give. If you have two people who are absolutely identical, both of them have everything that they need. There's nothing to give. If all I had was money, and you had all the money that you could possibly use, I have nothing to give you unless there's something else that's lacking. So the ability to receive and the ability to give is contingent on difference. When there's no difference, when there's no difference, then there's autonomy, which is an enemy, and selfishness, which is an enemy. Okay, so that goes to there. But you could say, why not just have two Adams? Some of you may like books in which they divide people into different personality types. Did you ever see those? You know, there's the one who, the judger, or the feeler, the thinker. Okay, you're familiar with those? Okay. Then you have the Enneagram. They're also, he's a one. Did you ever have, like, okay. I mean, I remember the first time I heard this. I was teaching, and, you know, there was a particularly difficult student, and someone says, you're such an eight. What on earth? Okay, so why didn't he just create two Adams, or 10 Adams? He could have created a whole human population, and each one of them has a different personality type. So the idea there, and I want you to get this, the difference between men and women are meant to be physical, intellectual, emotional, and spiritual. They're not just meant to be little personality quirks. Why? So that the need to receive will be intellectual, physical, emotional, okay, that it'll be real. So because of this, God created two different genders. Okay. Or Chaim takes this a little bit deeper, and he says, when you look at the physical world, everything has two genders. This is true of plants, this is true of animals, and this is to show us that this interdependency, receiving and giving, is part of the very fabric of reality. Okay. Now, if you want to look at the spiritual side of the differences between men and women, I want to introduce you to Maharal's vocabulary. Okay? So he talks a lot about Chomer and Tzura. A lot. Okay, so he sometimes, instead of using the words Chomer and Tzura, which I'm going to explain in a moment, we'll talk about Mashpia and Mushpa, which are easy to confuse. Okay. What's Chomer? What's Tzura? The word Chomer means material. The word tsura means form. Form and matter. Everything you will ever see is made out of form and matter. So this banister is made out of wood and it has a specific shape. Right? So there's form and matter. Okay. So if you're talking about the spiritual difference between men and women, the physical differences are apparent. The intellectual differences are also pretty apparent. Okay, but I'll go back to them. The real difference, he says, is that men have a great need to articulate tzura, to say this is what it is. Women have substance. They want to find definition as opposed to give definition. I realize that this is very abstract. So let's bring this down to real life. Okay, so what we would say is that women are substantial. So how does this relate to anything real? The Gemara says that every child has three partners, the parents and Hashem. And each provides something. So Gemara says, what do they provide? So he says, the wife provides the red matter, the husband provides the white matter, and Hashem provides the spiritual soul. Okay, then it asks, and what's the white matter and what's the red matter? And it answers itself by saying, the red matter is the flesh and blood. The white matter is the skeleton and the brain. Is this true biologically? No. This is true spiritually. Women give the child the substance that gives them personality, that makes them themselves, which is why a person is Jewish if who is Jewish? Their mother is Jewish. Men give form, ideas, and structure. Okay. So the basic picture is the substance of a person is pretty unchangeable, but ideas and theories move. So this is why, again, a child is Jewish if the mother is Jewish. The mother is Chomer, the husband is Tzura. This makes sense? So let's look how this works practically. Okay, so we said men and women are different and should be different. So the differences are intellectual, emotional, physical, and spiritual. Let's talk intellectual because this is the most controversial of all of the differences. Okay, men and women both think. I want to say that as an introduction. So you say, well, women don't think and they just feel. No. Okay, men and women both think. The seat of thought is the brain. Is that indisputably true? Is it or not? It's not the underarm, it's not your finger, it's the brain. Are men and women's brains physically identical? No. Okay. So, what? What do you mean it depends on what? Is the brain hormones? Hormones are produced by the brain. Okay, by the pituitary gland, the whole endocrine system. But what are the differences? There are two main differences. One is relative and the other is absolute. So here's what I mean by a relative difference. Is it accurate to say that men have more muscle than women? Is that accurate?
Yes.
Is that true for every single man and every single woman? No, that's called a relative difference. But there are absolute differences. Is it true that women have ovaries? Is it true that men don't? Is that true across the board? Yes, okay, so that's called an absolute difference. The relative difference between men and women is the different development of the sides of the brain, okay? In general, the parts of the brain that have to do with spatial differentiation, men are stronger. In verbal differentiation, women are stronger. In general, but this is only relative. The absolute definition, meaning this is true for all men and all women, is that there's much more electricity connecting the two sides of a woman's brain than a man's. Which doesn't mean, by the way, that women think more. Okay, I just want to point this out. Because there's less order. Oops. Okay. So all I'm demonstrating through this is that we don't think identically. I'm not even going to tell you about how men think and how women think. Just that we don't think identically. And that this is good because that allows for taking and giving. If we don't think identically, are our feelings the same? No, because our feelings always originate with our thoughts. So these differences are real and are deep and have to do, at a spiritual level, with Chomer and Tzura and the ability to receive and give with each other ideally in absolute unity. So you would think, now that the Torah is being given, the next part of the narrative would be, and Hashem gathered all of the Jews together and gave them the Torah, saying, okay, but it doesn't say that. It says, Hashem instructs Moshe, and says, Ko tomar lebet Yaakov, v'taged levnei Yisrael. This is what you should say to the house of Yaakov, and tell the sons of Israel. So that meant that Moshe was meant to address the women first. The women are called the house, the men are called the sons. So the idea of addressing the women first is difficult. Okay, what is there about being chomer, about being substance with no form, about being a person whose sides of the brains are connected and who may be more feeling in a certain sense? Why should they hear first? So I want to tell you something that I'm sure you've seen in life. Okay, because women are chomer, their receptivity to Torah is greater. They want to know, what does God want of us? So I want to tell you something. In the Baal Tshuva community, it's far easier to makarav a woman than a man. Did you know this? And I want to tell you the reason. Women will say, either overtly or subvertly, but where is the truth, and what does it mean to me, and what should I do? Women seek tzura. Maharal points out that this, like everything else, has a negative side and a positive side. In general, all of the mitzvot are stated in the Torah thus, in masculine. Lo tigdov, don't steal, masculine. Who are most of the thieves? Okay. Lo tirtzach, don't murder. And in Hebrew grammar, masculine includes feminine. There's an exception. When it's talking about witchcraft, it says, machshefa lo techayeh, don't let a witch live. Why? Because the same way men given an aggressive nature or whatever are more likely to murder, women given their need to find spiritual definition, if they don't turn to Hashem, what will they turn to? Something else. Okay, so when you look at New Age nonsense, not everything New Age is nonsense, but there is New Age nonsense. Is that true or not?
Yeah.
Do women move towards this?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not because of foolishness or deficiency, it's because of their desire to seek. Women have a strong desire to seek definition, to seek a spiritual path that speaks to them. So the question is still left, so why are they addressed first? So another answer that's given is because of the effect that women will have on men. Let's go back to the Garden of Eden. We have the first separation of gender. The snake addressed who first? Who did the snake talk to? Chava. Why? So I want to tell you something again about Chomer and Tzura. It's easier to convince her to do what he wants because he'll give her form, a path. Do this. Okay, yeah? And he knew, the snake knew, if he convinces Chava, then he's also got Adam. Did this happen? Was she able to convince him? Yes. So she's both more easily convinced and can also more easily convince someone else. And this could be used for the bad or for the good. Okay, so the women are addressed first. They have to hear it first because they want it more and they'll absorb it more and they'll affect the men and affect their children and affect all generations. And the style that they were presented was also different. It says, Kotomar lebet Yaakov. There are different words in Hebrew for speaking and for conveying words. Amira, to talk, to say, is meant to, it's usually used as the way we speak in conversation. Even in modern Hebrew, you would say, Hu amar li. Okay, this is what he said. But taged means tell it. Even in English, when you say, tell him what it is. It's a much harsher form of language. Okay, and in fact, taged is related to the word gid, which would mean a sinew or a vein. Think about eating meat at somebody's Shabbos table. You don't want a piece of veiny meat. And in fact, you're going to find yourself chewing and chewing and chewing and chewing, and since you're at somebody else's table, it's impolite to what? Spit it out. Okay, so whatever. Okay, the men was given the Torah in a way in which they would feel its severity. The women felt its closeness. And this is very descriptive about the way men and women respond to spirituality. Okay, Men like it tough. They like a challenge. They like to do battle. Women like closeness in conversation. The real goal is always connection. So I want you to think about this. Even when you speak to somebody harshly, I can't believe what you did. What kind of idiot does this? You're making connection. Is that true? When you don't speak to someone at all, then there's disconnect. So the basic rule is any kind of conversation is a connective. So you have two different approaches to Torah. One comes from closeness, and the other comes from challenge. And this again goes back to Gan Eden. Adam was told, conquer the world. Chava was told, you are mother of all living things. These are two very different identities and approaches. So again, we have the same goal, Goy Kadosh, Mamlechet Kohanim, and two different approaches. So now, all of this is backdrop. Now let's talk about things that are real. So historically, the way women learned Torah and the way women transmitted their influence over others was not through book learning. It was through osmosis. So there are really two ways that people learn. They learn through example, or they learn from information, from books. And both ways have advantages and disadvantages. What's the advantage of learning by example? You may follow the leader. You see anything to think about raising children? Which is better, to tell them what to do or show them an example of what should be done? Why is that the case? What's the advantage of what? It's real. Okay. And you learn the nuances. And you learn the kavana. So historically, women learned through example. Were there exceptions to this? Yes. Were there always exceptions? Yes. Is learning through example the same thing as not learning? No. So when the Torah was given, some of you may know this, some of you may not, Moshe was the one who conveyed the Torah to the men. Miriam conveyed it to the women. Rashi brings this. Because the voice that women hear the most and hear the best is a feminine voice. The voice of connection. The voice of example. Okay, a voice that connects spiritually and emotionally and not just intellectually. Okay, this is how it's been done historically. Okay, then things began to fall apart. Okay, why did things fall apart? What created the situation we have today where virtually all women learn almost exclusively from books? What happened? So let's go back. Okay, so if you were to go back, let's say 250 years, what you would see in an observant family, the husband would be learning from books. The majority of husbands in those years, we're going back 250 years, were not rabbis, certainly didn't have kollel. They didn't have kollel then at all. When did they learn? Whenever they could. In the morning, at night, they didn't have organized yeshivas 250 years ago. I don't know if you realize this. Okay. And it was tough. And the tougher it is, the more they like it. Okay, the three hardest mesechtaot in Shas are Nida, Erevin, and Yevamos. Okay, the favorite mesechta in yeshivas is Yevamos. That's how they like it. Okay, clear? Okay, and how did she know Torah? She knew it through her heart, she knew it through her eyes, she knew it through information that was conveyed orally, and she did it. So if you go back even earlier than 250 years ago, go back to the Inquisition. We have an introduction to a sefer written by the Chassid Yavetz, who wrote about a surprise that he had. When the Inquisition became forceful, his expectation was that the more scholarly the men were, the more resistant they would be to the Inquisition, and that the women and the Amoratsim were doomed. That's what he thought would happen. What did happen? The women withstood the temptations far, far more even than the scholarly men. Why is that? So I want to take you into something deep. Because everything we said until now about Chomer and Surah, wanting form, wanting structure, whose structure do women really want? Hashem. And the name of that will is Emunah. Women are stronger in Emunah than men are. And because of this, their ability to withstand temptation was greater. What's Emunah? Emunah is knowing everything is from Hashem, therefore everything ultimately is purposeful and good, and if it doesn't feel good, it's there for tikkun. You can't argue with Emunah. You can't debate with Emunah. You can't study Emunah. So now we know where women were historically. Then everything fell apart. The reason why everything fell apart was a convergence of two things simultaneously. One was the technological revolution, which suddenly gave women the structural capacity to attend school. All of a sudden, women are going to school, non-Jewish schools, because they have the leisure to do so. Okay. So that meant that women were getting information that had nothing to do with Emunah. Why? Because at the very time that women were freed because of technological progress, which is a good thing, the world was becoming less and less Emunah-oriented. So if you go back 200 years ago, 250 years ago, atheism was beginning to flower. Religion was becoming more and more peripheral. So what women were learning was everything that isn't Emunah. And this is where they were drawing their structure from. So things got, when you look at Jewish history, this is a sentence that usually works, progressively worse. Okay, whenever, if you're ever tested in Jewish history, let's say for some reason you have to take a test, and the teacher says, and then what happened? Oh, you could always say, and then things got worse, and you'll be right. Okay. So things got worse. Now I want you to look at your own childhood. Give me an example of an innocent secular children's book that you read as a child that you would let your own child read. Something innocent and sweet and good.
Little Eddie.
What? Little
Eddie.
Little who?
Eddie.
Eddie? I don't even know Little Eddie. Okay, Little Eddie. Anything else?
The Runaway Bunny.
Dr. Seuss. Let's go a little older. Bambi. Look, the three bears. And once there were individuals who broke into someone's home, and okay, they then moved to Fulton Street. Okay, whatever. But okay, so let's leave that alone. Also, let's leave Sleeping Beauty alone. Also, but let's go Little Women. Okay, Anne of Green Gables. These were wholesome books. Okay, move it up to books that you read in junior high school. Wholesome books, good books. What?
Tom Sawyer.
Move it up, a recent book that you read that's wholesome and good. Who reads? We have internet. No. Okay, no?
Battle
Plans. No. Not a Torah book. Not a Torah book. No? An innocent secular book. Okay, there are interesting autobiographies that are out there. There are interesting books about nature that are out there. There are all sorts of interesting books that are out there, many of which are worth reading, some of which are not. Okay? But God isn't a character in any of them. Have you noticed this? He's not there in the better autobiographies, and he's not there in the books you read in high school, and he's not there in the books you read in college if you went to college, and if he's not even there in the books that you read when you were in Gan, in the secular world. They have moved God where? Out. So because of this, the need for women to find meaning and to seek naturally flows towards what? Anything else. So when you look at Sarah Schneur's life, her sister Manya was a socialist. This is the most normal possible response to the times in which they lived. She wanted meaning. She wanted structure. She wanted to do something that had spiritual depth. Make the world a better place. Makes sense. And in fact, Sarashtira wrote about this once. She wrote that her sister took her to a meeting they had on Friday night. So I want you to see the household. There were Gera Hasidim. The father is saying Sfas Emes to the boys. The girls are spacing out or eating kugel. Okay. And afterwards there's a meeting. And they went into a hall. And there's a platform with a dais. And the leader, who was a woman, lit candles. This is on Friday night late. And said, we're dispelling the darkness and superstition of religion. This is what Sarashnira's sister put herself into because she was living in a time in which religious thought was viewed as superstitious nonsense, as anti-spiritual. Could you see where this is so? So we've been robbed through the circumstances of Western reality of approaching religion through emuna. So because of this, today, women learn from books. So now our topic was the approach to Matan Torah. So there are three things that you have to draw from this. The first is that women want Torah very badly. The reason why Hashem could address them first is because they wanted to say Nasa V'Nishma so badly. Women want spiritual structure and meaning and are seekers and have emuna. So when Shavuos comes, you should open your heart to that. All of these preparatory weeks of Sfirat HaOmer, when you're trying to get rid of all of the blockages that prevent you from seeing your own emuna, okay, are the way you'll get there. That's the first thing to know, that this is what you want. The next thing that you have to know, and this is very important, is the level of influence that women have, which is greater than the influence that men have. So even though when you want to know what does the Torah say, you go to a rabbi, as you should. But the influence of women is very great. The Gemara describes it thus. It says, rather unflatteringly, both to men and women, more than the cow, than the calf wants to drink, the cow wants to give milk. So every man wants to affect, to conquer and to affect and to give in proportion to how much the woman and his family will receive and pass it on. So what that means is by showing one's husband, one's children, the people in one's environment, that this is what you want and this is what you believe in and this is what you treasure, they'll be inspired to take it in. It depends on the women. So we have two things. This is what women want more than they want anything else. And this is how their effect will be felt more than in any other way. The third thing is that in the world as it is now, the only way that women can get Torah is through learning Torah. You're not going to pick it up from the environment. So I want to tell you what it looks like when people do pick it up from the environment, which is rare to find. Years and years ago, when my children were young, we lived in Geula, and I wanted to send my children to a Yiddish-speaking kindergarten because I wanted them to learn Yiddish. Okay, so the Ganenet was a young girl from Me'ah Sharim who finished their school system. That means she was at least 16. But she was good with children. She came from a large family. She was a very good Ganenet. Okay, she once had to tell me off for something I had done wrong. Now, I could tell you with absolute certainty, she did not learn the laws of Tochacha, the laws of rebuke, from reading the Rambam. But she knew them. She knew about privacy, about being specific, about listening to the other person's response, about repeating what they said so they feel heard, about telling them what you want of them. She knew the whole five conditions. Where'd she know it from? In her very sheltered society, in her family, she probably never heard an adult rebuke another adult in any other way. That's how she knew it. This is not the case for anybody in this room. Is that true? So the only way we know is through learning. The only way to know is through learning. So the act of learning for a woman is an act for which he's given reward. Not the reward of a man who's commanded to learn, but reward. What does reward mean when you talk about reward in Torah? What is it? Did you ever wonder about that? Oh, the priest have schar. Where in Olam Haba? What is that supposed to mean? It's nothing material. Reward is closeness to Hashem. When a woman learns, she draws closeness to Hashem. I'm sure some of you have heard this. You learn something inspiring. It could be in a shir, it could be from a sefer. And as you're learning, you feel close to Hashem. As you're learning, you feel the ahava and the yira. So you have to learn. Okay, the words of learning affect you and give you the ability to transmit something. The question is what? So we have recommendations from the sages. What's their recommendation? So the recommendation is not Talmud. Okay, not Talmud. Not Torah Shebal Peh. But this is tricky because we're not Karaites. If you're learning Chumash and Rashi, are you learning Torah Shebal Peh? Of course you are. Where's Rashi's comments coming from? So what's meant by that? Clearly it's not the literal sense. You don't want to learn an eye for an eye and think, okay, get the pincers. Okay. Of course you have to know Torah Shebal Peh. So I asked Rav Elyashiv. So here's what he said. He said anything that's inspiring and anything that's informational is what women should learn. Anything that's technical, anything that's learning lishma that doesn't have practical application, is not what women should learn. So I asked for an example, and he didn't say, not Gemara, yes, Chumash, which is how we tend to... He said, not the hard Rashis in Mishpatim, but yes, the Agadata. So he didn't differentiate by saying, not this book, yes, this book. He differentiated on the basis of what's inspiring and what's informational. So how do you know what you should learn, you personally? So there's a rule there. Learn what inspires you and learn what gives you information. Is the answer going to be the same for every person? Absolutely not. But the dveikus that you have to Hashem comes from knowing what he wants of you and what he says to you. So I want to illustrate this. If I were to tell you, I know Obama, would you believe me? You shouldn't. Okay. So suppose, I know Obama, and you say, you know Obama? And I say, yeah, I saw his picture in a magazine. Is that knowing Obama? No. So you would say, that's not knowing Obama. So I'd say, well, what's knowing Obama? So, well, did you ever communicate with him? Now, what I'm saying next isn't true. Suppose I say, I used to be a waitress, and one day, when Obama was still in Congress, he went over to me, sat down by the table, and said, no milk, two sugars. Okay, does that mean I know Obama? What would the words I know Obama mean? You have to have a relationship to know someone. That's a loaded word in this context. Knowing what he thinks and what he says. The only way to know Hashem is through the Torah. You have to know his thought and his will. Now, most of the time when you do a mitzvah, it's through something else. For instance, with tzedakah. You have money that you earned. Okay, you give it to someone poor. So what's the medium? The money. Right? So it's Hashem's will, but you need something else as a medium. You eat kosher food. That requires buying the food, preparing the food. There's a lot of stuff that fits into this category called medium. When you learn Torah, there's no medium. Your mind and Hashem's mind at the moment that you're learning are literally in the same thought. There's no level of intimacy that could be greater than that, even physical intimacy. So there's no mitzvah that opens your heart to Av and Yira the way learning does. So again, in today's world, learning means knowing what's inspiring, knowing what's practical. But you have to be willing to say, I want to know your will, Hashem. I want to know your ways. And this is going to be the tzura of my life. And if I take this to, and what happens if not? Because women are seekers and seek tzura. Where else do they find self-definition if it's not through learning and inspiration and knowledge? Where else? What are the other addresses in our communities? I'm not talking about secular women. The shops, the net. Is this not true? Because our need for something that gives us connection and that fills our time is real. So what Shavuos should inspire you towards is wanting more than that. Wanting Shavuos should be more than cheesecake. Even more than cheesecake. I don't want to diminish cheesecake. Even more than cheesecake. Okay? And it should take you to being able to affect other people with passion. I'm going to conclude by telling you a true story. Okay, some of you may have heard of Rav Reuven Elbaz. Do you know who I'm talking about? How many of you know who I'm talking about? Okay, wow, three of you. Okay, so if you go back, say to the early 80s, okay, something very interesting was happening in Israel. When the state first formed, within several years, from 1948 to 1956, that's a very short amount of time, the Middle East basically emptied itself of Jews. Jews were flooding into Israel from Morocco, from Syria, from Lebanon, which is really then was part of Syria, Libya, every place. Okay. The government had to contend with this flow of thousands and thousands and thousands of people. In those years, the government had an agenda. What was the agenda?
Secularizing
them. Did they think that they were doing something good for them? Yes, they did. Okay? So they were settled in these ghastly development towns, which never developed. They were trained to see everything Western as modern and progressive and new and Israeli, and everything else as being what? Old, primitive, superstitious, rejectable. Virtually all families at the beginning held on to tradition. Shabbat was Shabbat, and Friday night there's Kiddush, and okay, until the boys went to the army. And when the boys went to the army in those years, it was all over. They had Ashkenazi officers, mostly kibbutznikim, and they were taught, like, come on, like, we're all going to the beach. What's wrong? Okay, whatever. And they came back, and they affected their families. Okay, what turned things around? Okay, what turned things around? So more or less simultaneously, Rav Ovadia became a big person in Israel, going from place to place, willing to speak to any audience that would have him. I remember when he came to the Israeli Neve with maybe 30 students, and he was willing to spend his time on them. Okay, so one of the bright lights at that time was also Rav Reuven Elbaz. Okay, so he was young then. Very, very, even now he's very, very dynamic. He can go to a development town, go to the supermarket, and do what the Baal Shem Tov did in years earlier. You've heard the Baal Shem Tov stories about the Baal Shem Tov standing on a box in the marketplace, clapping his hands and say, want to hear a story? Okay, got this? That's what Rav Reuven Elbaz was able to do. He called his followers his shock troopers. They would go to a development town, make an evening, rent an auditorium, and they turn things around. His chain of yeshivas, which is called Or Chaim, which is named after his ancestor, the Or Chaim, okay, probably is the largest chain of yeshivas in Israel. Okay, today, and he's not the only one, again, Rav Ovadia is the real star here, there's virtually no Sephardi family in Israel that doesn't have at least one Baal Tshuva. Okay, it's a big revolution. He wrote about his own youth. So they came, and they lived in a Ma'abara. Ma'abara was a tent city that they were placed in even before the development towns. Then they went to live in Tveria. And his father got menial work, and his mother was a housewife. And his older brother went to the army. So everything was following the plan. Okay, his older brother somehow held on to himself in the army, which was very rare, but it certainly eroded him to some degree. When he came home after the 3 years, he told his parents, I'm leaving Tveria. Tveria is no placeville. Tveria has no possibilities. I'm moving to Tel Aviv. His mother realized that it would be impossible to argue with him. So what she did was she said, Beseda, Beseda, Beseda. Then after which she turned to her husband and said, we're moving to Tel Aviv. So he moved to Tel Aviv. The father had to leave his job. They had to rent out their apartment. They had to work much harder in Tel Aviv than in Tveria because the rents are very different. They lived very near their son. Stayed with him until she could marry him off to a nice Jewish girl. And then they moved back to Tveria. Okay, so that's what a woman does. That's a woman's Torah. It's love of Torah, love of mitzvah that affects the entire family. The brother has sons who are Rosh Yeshiva. So this is where you have to put yourself. You have to demonstrate your love of Torah. You have to affect other people with your love of Torah. Rambam says in the mitzvah of loving Hashem that if you love someone, you want others to love him. So your inspiration and your knowledge is something that you're meant to live with such vivacity and such force that it affects everybody around you. Okay, so this is what I'm going to end with. And if you have questions, the time is now. Yeah?
Is there a big difference between a Jewish woman and a non-Jewish woman?
In this regard, no. And this is why you see also, lahavdil, many, many havdalot. If you were to go lahavdil to a church, you would see far more women than men. Okay? And what you would see is, again, because the Torah is forever and is eternal, the Torah gave the men many mitzvot through which they could express their masculinity. So you'll find men in the Bet Knesset, not just women, because it's not all emotion and spirit. So I would suggest two things. One is figuring out the child's Yetzer Tov. Everybody has one. And giving an expression to it. Some children like volunteering. Some children like excitement. You have to find an expression for the Yetzer Tov. And then let him learn something that interests him and inspires him. If it isn't Yevamos, find something else. Yeah?
Up here. Or upstairs.
I was going to say, I hear a voice. I feel like Martin Luther King. I have a dream. Okay. Okay. Yeah?
My former student of yours, can you recommend some like very tangible things that women can do in the home to bring out that inspiration, like for teenage girls or for even like for preteen boys? Because the battle is very big. Mm-hmm. The books in the library and then all the things that their friends are doing. So how do you... really tangibly and concretely inspire them?
So depending on who they are, everybody is different. For some girls, putting them in a position of influence, like inviting students or whomever as guests, and they have to take charge, and they have to be the ones who are mashpia, explain to her how to do netilat yadayim could be very powerful. For some girls, it's learning. I would recommend for girls, I do this with my granddaughters, Rav Lau, the chief rabbi, you speak English, so it's different. Okay. I don't know, maybe it's in translation. His book on Pirkei Avos is so tangible and so current and so delightful that I found that my granddaughters were willing to learn Pirkei Avos.
The question okay. is more, what can I as a mother do to inspire? Meaning like things that they can see me doing, things that they can see me
They could
doing.
See you asking a shiloh when you don't know what to do. They could see you going to a shir. They could see you picking up a sefer. They could see that your interest in whatever your husband is bringing into the house with Torah is real and passionate, and that this is what you respect in him, and that this is what you'll encourage more than, let's say, a promotion at work.
And if they come to you and they want to tell you about a book that they've read,
listen.
It's a secular book. Do you listen?
You absolutely listen. But the way all books work. You took literature courses. The plot of all books is the introduction of characters, the struggle and the resolution. So once you know this, why are you reading them? Okay, whatever. I have to tell you something. I don't have to say, but here's something funny. I like those kind of books. So I was reading one of these serials in one of the From magazines. And it was, I think, Edgar Schwartz's one, what was it called, where they were all living out in the frontier. But I'm talking about Full Moon. Full Harvest. I was reading Full Harvest. I was up to a very dramatic part. Will she die in childbirth? Won't she die? Okay. So I'm sitting in the living room, and tears are coming down my face. Okay. My son gets up. He looks at me, and he said, what happened? So I said, I'm just reading something in this story. So he said, did it happen, though? Is it real? So I said, no. So he says, you enjoy this? I'm saying it's like all registering. Women are incomprehensible. It gives them pleasure, Shabbos morning, to cry about events that never happened. Okay. So listen to the story, empathize with what's going on, and try to bring in the meaning there, because the whatever is good in the story in the end reflects a Torah value, and whatever is bad doesn't. And you could bring in a lot without her, without using the word Torah. Okay. More questions? Yeah?
So, okay,
right.
Mm-hmm. Is it enough to do it through a
shiur?
Or
oh, sure. Of course. Shiurnale.com. You know what I'm talking about? It's online seminary. Okay. Of course. Learning doesn't have to. It has to be inspiring and informational. The medium is not what's important. Again, some women like learning from a sefer. That's their inspiration. That's a different question. But I have to tell you, I'm trying to hold this back. I don't buy what you're saying. What you're saying is women are so busy today because they work and have households that they have no time to learn. This is true for many women. It's also true that people seem to have time to shop. And somebody must be making these unbelievable recipes from Bina magazine. That, you know, like they have 28 ingredients and they say things like, and here's how you could do homemade crackers. Who wants to make homemade crackers? You know, like, somebody must be doing this. So, you know, makes you wonder. Okay. More questions? Yes. Yeah, so let me just think of a story that everybody is familiar with. It's like an adult story. Let's say the story of the civil rights movement. Let's say somebody's reading one of the biographies of Martin Luther King Jr., some of which are very eloquent and beautiful. So you get up to the part of his I have a dream speech, which wasn't original. Okay, but whatever. And you say his dream of like liberty, equality, he made that happen. He did it through touching people's conscience. You know, the Torah has always said that everyone has a conscience. That's enough.
But that's a real story?
Yes, it is. Okay.
Okay,
so a novel. Okay. It's hard to me. I don't read novels. I'm trying to think of a novel that I remember, like an adultish novel. Give me a novel. Okay. No? Nobody wants to admit to reading novels.
I don't know if that's like Harry Potter. I don't know, like any child wanting something, they want to tell you about it, and it's not necessarily.
Okay, so let's say again the plot is that you have the introduction of characters, and somebody has some sort of a disability, and the struggle is how she overcomes her disability, and the resolution is how even though she thought she overcame it, no, she didn't, but she found true resolution at the end. Through Michael. Okay. So, we've all seen books like those? Okay. So, telling her, you know, everybody has their struggles. She was handicapped. But everybody has struggles. You know, I know people who, and then give an example of two struggles, but it all ultimately makes people noble. That's why the Torah never avoids the fact that there's struggle. Okay, clear? But don't talk too much. Okay, otherwise you get eyes that roll. heads that are like, yeah. Going once, twice, okay, yeah.
I guess we realize that inspirational is very individualized, but what really is informational? Halacha, Musar.
Different people, different things. There are some people who really, I mean, most women don't, but some people really do like the intricacy of halacha. So for something like that, learning Mishneh Berurah, learning Hilchos Shabbos and Mishneh Berurah so they know it cold, is going to inspire them and inform them. For somebody else, it'll put them to sleep. So you have to know it's too individual to have guidelines.
I have a feeling that people don't want their kids to be writing books at the same time, therefore, because of the school and all that. I don't know how it is in Israel. Here, children do not, most of them don't read in Hebrew. Like
right.
Yeah. So what are we supposed to supplement it with? Like, what are they supposed to read?
Terrible from novels. You know those, like, Yankel goes to Russia on an espionage, Mickey Mouse at the Kotel, whatever, but in any case. The kids in Israel do the same thing. They read terrible from novels in Hebrew. Okay, there are also better ones. I mean, there are better ones. The Outcast, and what was the sequel to it, I don't remember. I don't know, it was historic in Hebrew. But there were good novels also. But, like, that's basically what kids read. Young kids, and I don't know if they have this in America, it became very faddish in Israel for young kids. They have from comic books. Do they have them here? Yeah, so, like, boys especially, like, horrible, violent from comic books. Let's watch how the Maccabees killed the Greeks! Okay, this is what they're like. See all the blood? Did you look at the one where the elephant was crushing his head? Okay, no, that's what. Okay, so that's what from kids read, yeah. Okay, Zehu for now, but don't go yet. You know I always collect tzedakah, okay? So today's tzedakah is for the Mishneh Berurah Kollel that our family started in my husband's memory. The way this one goes is you can either become a member, which means you enter a Yisachar Zavulin contractual relationship with one of the learners, or you give something. So I'm going to pass around some papers that are explanatory and the envelope. Okay. And now you go. No, okay, we'll have to tell you. I'm sure I'll call you the girl.